for which we have a special format. Peggy will give us a brief history of the Atlantic Group. Next, we will have a special presentation by Vince V. This will be followed by the information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 45 minutes. Help me welcome Peggy.
My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. Yes, tonight we celebrate the Atlantic Group's 13th anniversary. Now, early in 1994, I mentioned to Clancy that we were starting a group in New York, and we were going to call it the Atlantic Group. And Clancy said, you know what? I'll come for your first anniversary. And he's graciously returned for all of them. Thank you. Thank you, Clancy. And now some of the history of the Atlantic Group. Most groups, as you know, start out with a resentment and a coffee pot. The Atlantic Group did not. It started with a dream and some very good examples. The Pacific Group in L.A. and its founder, Clancy. I've been blessed with having been one of the founders, along with Van, who is no longer with us. But he was, without a doubt, the Atlantic Group's shepherd. I am, as Van was, humbled by our group's success. The fellowship that we chose 13 years ago has grown up around us, and our big book makes that promise. It was March 1st, 1994. We met for the first time at the Convent of the Sacred Heart, 5th Avenue and 91st Street. I had scouted that location and chose it because the recital hall had red velvet chairs and gold gilded frames. Perfect. Of course, the convent forgot that night that they had rented us the recital hall, and we were relegated to the library, which would seat, I think, 45 comfortably. Now, that night, we had 75. We had 75 because people heard, oh, you know, it's a new group, let's go, and we invited all our friends. We didn't have 75 every night after that. I mean, we were maybe 30, 40. But, of course, because we were relegated to the library, we learned early on that the Atlantic Group could take change, we could stand change, and we were mobile. In our fifth year, we had grown to 100, and the convent came to us and said, you have to lock the door after the 75th person. And they said, you know, you just have to turn them away. And we said, well, booze can keep them out, but we cannot. That's what we said. And so the hunt began for a new home. Lots of prayers later, on June 29th, 1999, the Christ Church invited us, and we are happily ensconced here. Our big book study was AG's second meeting. It started on February 5th, 1996. It meets now at the First Reformed Episcopal Church on Wednesdays. The beginners' meeting was our third meeting. It started on July 1, 1998, in the library of the convent. There were about 15 of us in attendance. It now meets on the fourth floor here at Christ Church, and the average attendance, I believe, is 150. Our fourth meeting became Steps and Traditions, bringing Atlantic Group to the West Side. So it started January 9, 2000, and it meets every Friday at the Universalist Church. Our call-up meeting on Sunday was our fifth meeting. It started October 13, 2002. It meets at the VA hospital on 23rd and 1st. I think their average attendance is about 175. Atlantic Group's number six meeting is our 11th step tradition meditation meeting, sorry, and that was started on February 28, 2005. It meets on Mondays at the Karen Foundation on East 58. Six meetings a week and still growing. Now, I will not say that the Atlantic Group is the best group. That would sound like bragging instead of the unvarnished truth. But whatever we are, it is because of you members, your actions. You are living examples of recovery, unity, and service. God has blessed us, and I know these blessings will continue. When we were readying our 10th anniversary meeting, Van, who was too ill to come that night, sent me an email, and he said, maybe you could incorporate my feelings into your history talk. I read it on our 10th anniversary, and I'd like to read it to you again tonight, what he said. I will tell you why I believe that we're celebrating 10 years. Enough of you are willing to give up when you attend an Atlantic Group meeting, your personal desires, your needs, even your demands. Give up your individual, may I say, rights, that you follow consciously or not the first tradition. The group comes first, the individual second, albeit a close second. That you are obedient to avoiding the use of street language, dressing according to our dress code, and following another tradition, our primary purpose, carrying the message of AA. It is you, the individual member, from the newest of newcomers to the eldest of elders, being loving and tolerant of your group. That's what makes it work. It is because you make that sacrifice that we're here tonight. And if you keep that up, if you remain true to the group conscience, retain the structure, follow the traditions, you will meet 20, 30, and maybe more years and fill the room with AA music, laughter, and sharing of love for one another, for our fellowship, and especially our group. And those were Van's words. And now... And now I'd like to make way for the entertainment segment of our anniversary and introduce last year's chair, Vince.
We're going to use the entertainment word loosely. Can the steering committee come up, please? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We have a song. Every year we do something a little silly in honor of Rule 62, so tonight we're going to sing a song for you. And this song was originally sung by Julie Andrews. We have the steering committee here, by the way, and one ringer, which is Lisa, going to help us. This song was originally sung by Julie Andrews in a Broadway musical, The Sound of Music. Okay? So after an exhaustive search to find someone appropriate to sing the lead for Julie Andrews, in The Sound of Music, they picked me. You got a problem with that? So here we go. Calling my sponsor and taking right action, being a program of AA attraction, working the steps and the freedom it brings. These are Atlantic Group's favorite things.
When I'm feeling
suicidal or just tired and sad, I do the Atlantic Group's favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. There's more. Having commitments at every meeting, making the coffee or greeting and seating, being of service without any strings. These are Atlantic Group's favorite things.
When I'm feeling
suicidal or just tired and sad, I do the Atlantic Group's favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. Last verse. Listening to speakers refraining from booing, asking a newcomer, how are they doing? Sharing some time when our telephone rings. These are Atlantic Group's favorite things. When I'm feeling homicidal or just tired and sad, I do the Atlantic Group's favorite things, and then I don't feel
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dayton. Our Southern tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting and declining outside contributions. The baskets will now be passed. Thank you for... And now for our main speaker tonight, please welcome Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland. I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome everyone, people in the Half Measures balcony. I have kind of a bad rap on me. It's really a bad rap. Some people say I'm kind of a hard-hearted, semi-cynical, tough guy. And I'm not. Maybe it's because I've gotten older, I've become kind of a pussycat or something. But I was thinking tonight, it sounds kind of corny, but you got to go along with me. If I had one day to live, if someone told me I had one day to live, I would try to come to this meeting and ask that group to sing. It would make that last day seem like forever. But I am happy to be here for the 13th anniversary of this group. I remember when it started, and it was kind of tremulous, and for a while. Usually when activist groups start, the other groups are out there saying, don't go to that group, they're a bunch of Nazis. And that happens all over the world and amongst activist groups. So I was very glad to see this progress and flourish, and certainly Van and Peggy did a wonderful job. I was thinking about that today. I was sitting there kind of pensive. Just a year ago, wasn't it, that I went up to see Fan in the hospital. He was very sick, and then he died thereafter. And his last thoughts were, I hope the meeting will be fine. And it will, of course, because of Van's wishes, but because people get involved and do things and take actions. When meetings do not perform a function, they wither. When meetings lose their focus and become trying to be all things to all people and get away from the traditions of AA, we're all, like, for instance, that terrible... It sounds all right on the surface, you know, this thing. It's all one big disease. Narcotics, addiction, alcoholism, food. We can't keep people out from participating. And I'll tell you, if you know where that phrase comes from. It was created by a treatment center that only had one van. And, okay, everybody in the van, it's all one big disease, you know. And the reason that we do not do it very much, is we try to avoid it, is because there's only in the history of mankind, at least for 5,000 years, there have been people like us who react differently to alcohol. And for a long time, people didn't know what to make of it. In fact, until I was born, until after that. But in the old days, they thought they were possessed by devils and put them to death and send them away and lock them up and flog them. And all these years... Well-meaning people have tried to help people like us. Medicine and psychiatry and the law and social services. And nothing has ever worked. There's only been two brief periods in the history of mankind where there's been places like you and me to go, for you and me to go. One was in the early 1840s, of all things. Six old guys got together in a bar in Baltimore. One of them just got out of jail. He said, oh, that chaplain down there, he says he knows how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys are the only ones who know how I feel. And they all agreed, yeah, we know it. But we're all dying from drinking. What can we do? So they agreed to try to help each other stay sober. They drew up a little compact. We will stay sober. They all signed it. They elected officers. Five officers. The sixth guy just got screwed, I guess. He just... But everybody laughed at them. You know, these drunken bums, they can't keep themselves sober. They're going to now keep each other sober to laugh. But they stayed sober. And they got some guys came down from Philadelphia and saw that. They went back, tried to start it in Philadelphia. And some people came up from Washington. Some people came from Boston. Boston really took off for some reason. New York. After a while, they had a bunch of little meetings of guys helping each other stay sober. And since it was the first of its kind, they called themselves after the first president of the United States, who was the first of his kind. They called them the Washingtonians. And after a year, they had maybe 300 people. And nobody paid much attention because they were very small, very low and obscure, but tremendous when you think about it. Near the end of their second year, they started in March. Usually I get a little further into my talk. Near the end of the second year, they started in March, so they decided to take Washington's birthday as their anniversary. So they decided February 22nd was their anniversary. And all over the country, they talked to him, whether they could find a group. They wrote him a letter and said, on the 22nd of February, call it our second anniversary, and have somebody from your community to come in and talk to us. Somebody's not necessarily a big shot, but somebody who's going to be a big shot. And we don't really care what they say. But we want them to see that we're not crazy people. We're really doing something for them. And so all over the country on February 22nd, 1842, they came out in Springfield. The guy they got was Abraham Lincoln. You read a book of Abraham Lincoln's speeches. You read a speech of the Washingtonians, 1842. And a lot of it's just boilerplate, but he gets to a point. He says, you know, I know you men personally, and I worked with you, and I understand you. You're intelligent, fine people. I have never understood your thirst. That's something I guess I'll never understand. But I'm so happy you're doing something about it. I mean, that's the way it was to meaningful people. By 1845, now this is odd. When you stop and think, there were no telephones, no communications to speak of. Along the way, they had gotten some rather important oratorical performers who could give mass talks. But by 1845, it was estimated they had 100,000 members, sober drunkards in America. Unbelievable. When you stop and think, after 5 years, didn't have 1,000. And they, in 1845, the leaders there did the same thing, because it sounds right in AA today. You hear it in meetings, it sounds right. Gee, if we're able to help drinkers, we should be able to help all sorts of people with their problems. We should be able to help narcotics addicts who don't have a drinking problem. Not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium. We should help people who are emotionally unfit. We should get involved in politics. Maybe we should all stamp out the sale of alcohol. Let's get rid of alcoholism. We'll get involved in, some got involved in allowing, getting Texas into the Union. All sorts of wonderful operations. Some got into the slavery movement. And this group of people, dynamic, dedicated people, gave it all they had. By 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct and they all died drunk. Very few exceptions. I have a book home written by... Is our starting time difficult for you? Why? God, there's a whole parade of them coming down now. Well, there's so many of you, I don't want you to miss the first part, so... my name is Clancy Immelsland, and I'm here... But I had a book written by one of the few survivors in 1860, which said, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well. Then we decided to stop really working so much with drunkards, but to help all kinds of people. And after that, people just lost interest. And that was the Washingtonians. And there was never a place for people to go after that until in the 1940s, 1935, 1940. Incidentally, I don't want to give them any publicity, but they deserve it. I went to the opening last night of a play called Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And I was prepared to dislike it, because I know they'd dramatize it and make it crappy. And I was impressed, because I'm kind of a student of the history of AA, and they were dead on. In fact, it gave you little dimensions that I never even thought about. You know, Dr. Bob's wife grinding him while he drank, and Bill Wilson being ground by Lois Wilson because he could not hold a job. But it really gets to the heart of AA. And I'm not saying you should go to it or not go to it, but if you like the history of AA, it's there. But at any rate, in the 1940s, here's another thing. As most of us know, AA started off very slowly. And then at the end of 1940, the San Francisco Post had a guy who specialized in unveiling corruption. He had just written a series on the corruption in the labor unions in Philadelphia waterfront. His next assignment was work your way into this Alcoholics Anonymous thing and get the goods on them. And he did, and much to his surprise, they were what they said they were. People doing it for fun and for free, trying to help one another, going way out of their way. He couldn't believe it. And he wrote this glowing article, which most of us who have been sober a while know about, appeared in 1941 in March. Just in March, this is the anniversary of it, of the Saturday Evening Post in 1941. And AA took off, because all over the country, people had never heard of an answer for the drunkard in their family. And they all wrote to this guy in New York. And they got thousands of letters. And all over the country, little groups started, and things started to go. And people all over the country were starting to go. And for about a year and a half, it was the most exciting thing. Then it began to dwindle. And Bill Wills started getting letters. Well, our group has been fighting a lot inside of it. And we're not a group anymore, so don't send us any more stuff. And one by one, all over the country, people were fighting with each other. People were getting beefs about things. People were arguing how things should be done. And Bill Wilson, in 1945, he thought, if I could only get something to get people together. So he started the Grapevine, a magazine he thought would keep people together. It was a tabloid size, about the size of the New York Post at that time, and gradually shrunk. But that didn't help much. But late in 1945, some doctor in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine, sent in and said, Bill, I'd like to have you read this because it's kind of interesting. And Bill read it and was staggered. It was the story of the Washingtonians. He had never heard of it. And he went to the library and got some books and read about it and their dissolution and looked at the letters he was getting every day and thought, my God, we're just like them. We're going down. He didn't know what to do. And a last gasp effort to save AA at the end of 1945, because our lives are getting pretty close to being extinct, yours and mine. He wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian experience and the AA experience. In the long form, not the way you hear them sometimes in meetings itself. If you're kind of new, in the back of the books, there's the short form. The other side is the long form. In our group in Los Angeles, we read the long form once a month so that every newcomer knows what's going on. And he published them one by one. And unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous had the same problem in 1945 that it has now. It's full of alcoholics. We don't want to hear your damn rules. A lot of people rejected them out of hand. We don't want to have nothing to do with them. That's when Bill Wilson jumped into his motorcycle, stuck his wife in the sidecar, and went around to meetings, tried to explain, these aren't rules, they're trying to wait to save us. It got to a point, which is kind of sad when you think about it, in the archives. There are letters. Bill, we'd like to have you come and speak at our anniversary. But if you're going to speak what their traditions, don't bother coming. We don't want you. Which sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. It's very sad. And so eventually Bill and Dr. Bob, the co-founder, they got along well together. Their followers didn't like each other, but they got along well. And they told their followers, let's have a big meeting where the people from Los Angeles will come and the people from Houston and Miami and Cleveland and Chicago, all these people that are at each other's throats all the time. Let's get them all together so they can see what we're doing. And so they decided to have a meeting in Cleveland. And on the 4th of July weekend in 1950, the first largest group, except for the Washingtonians in the history of mankind, gathered in Cleveland for a meeting. I have the tapes of that meeting that weekend. It's very good. The quality of the tape is bad, but the quality of what was said is wonderful. And they, Bill and Dr. Bob talked that night, or that afternoon, Sunday afternoon. And Dr. Bob was dying of cancer at this time. So they said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. He said, well, I got to talk. He said, next to Bill, I'm the soberest. I got 15 years of sobriety. Unheard of. And so that day, his son on one side and his fellow on the other side took this tall, gaunt guy to the. And he gave a short talk that many people conceived to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't start off very big. He started off by saying, well, welcome to Cleveland. I hope you'll go back to tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all doing the same thing. We all get out of AA what we put into it. He says, I look over this crowd. There's a small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He says, I want to apologize for my health. I haven't been in bed most of the past few months. I haven't recovered as well as I thought. You know, it's just dull talk. Then he said, but I want to call your attention to two or three things that I think to be of interest. And it was very important because he knew he was dying, and this almost became his deathbed testament to AA. Because he was a great believer in this organization. And what he said was as true tonight in this group as it is ever anywhere in the world. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and use it kindly with kindness. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. When things are going our way, we're all just full of love. Oh, program works. God's in heaven. Really wonderful. We're here. But let somebody hurt our feelings or threaten us or put us down and he twists baby chicken's necks, that son of a bitch. Yeah. And finally he said, none of us would be here tonight if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe take us to a few meetings, to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are too busy to help our fellow alcoholic who still suffers. He said, thank you. He sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. I thought about that. I don't know why I even thought about this, just kind of a historical thing. In 1970, I was at the International Convention. They decided to have that big meeting every 5 years after that, because it went over so well. They had one in 1955 in St. Louis and 60 in Long Beach that I went to, and 65 in Toronto and 70 in Miami Beach. And I was very pleased in Miami Beach because I was the first I was asked to speak at that one. But Bill Wilson, he always spoke on Friday night. And, God, you cut the excitement with the knife. You go to these big conventions, thousands and thousands of people waiting for Bill to give his talk. It's just, exciting. And so, just as the meeting started, a woman came out and said, I'm very sorry, but Bill is too ill to speak. He probably will never speak again. We're very sorry. Thousands of people. Oh. And I said to the guy, what the hell happened? He said, he's got bad emphysema. He's dying from emphysema. And so they introduced some guy to replace him. Poor guy. We all, like good alcoholics, went. And on the way back to the hotel, I was talking with an old guy named John McHugh, he got sober under Dr. Bob. I said, isn't that too bad? We'll never hear Bill talk again. He said, he'll talk this weekend. I said, he won't. I talked to people in the New York office. They won't. He can't talk. He says, he's going to talk this weekend. I said, John, you're full of nothing. But I thought, maybe he knows something. So the next day, I went to the big meeting, and they had some speaker there who was supposed to speak, and he spoke. And the last one was Sunday morning. This may be it. And they introduced the speaker. He got up and spoke. And we just, About halfway through his talk, somebody came from behind stage and tugged on his sleeve. He turned and said, I have some wonderful news. An ambulance has just brought Bill to the back door. And they wheeled him in a wheelchair with tubes out of his nose. And the organist played Climb Every Mountain. And and he sat there, and you could hear the tape. He pulled himself up to the microphone. God will, to the effect of this, God will continue our work as long as there's work for us to do, and he wants us to do it, and we deserve to do it. And it sounds as though the tape breaks. He just fell back. He ran out of air. and they wheeled him out. And he died sometime thereafter. We were walking back to the hotel. I said, John McHugh, how in the hell did you know that he was going to speak? Nobody knew it. He said, listen, kid. When you're around AA, you're dealing with human beings. They may be wonderful, dedicated human beings, but they're human beings. Do you think Bill Wilson would want it said that he wouldn't talk when he was dying after Bob did when he was dying? That probably is true. But they introduced the traditions there, too, and at that meeting. And they, at that time, it's kind of funny, because there was such an undercurrent of anti-everything. You know, these guys explained, you know, we have no police. This is not a, these traditions, we can't even enforce them. We have no enforcement. There's no police. A lot of us old-timers think that was a mistake. In my hometown, I am known unjustly as something of a dictator-type sponsor. They say, you don't share. You tell people what you do. Yes, but it's for their own good. But the problem is, you can't really be a dictator in AA without the 100% agreement of the dictatee. All they ever to say is, screw you. And the dictatorship is over. I always thought it would be nice if we had people could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little training. But those traditions were put in, and although many of us ignore them now, I mean, a lot of people ignore them, they saved AA. And so you and I still have a place to go. You and I have a place to go. There's been two moments in the history of mankind where there's been alcoholics like us to go, a place for us to go. And you and I happen to be lucky enough to be born into the window where we can go. And the people in the 1810s were in the window where they could go in the 1840s. And it's so easy to come here. It doesn't cost anything. People find happiness and love here. And yet most people who come here don't stay here. It's been estimated by the National Institute of Health, at least as of 2003 about, that if alcoholics of our type, the chronic alcoholic, it is estimated in America today where there's an AA meeting in every town with a stoplight, and there's all in Los Angeles we have over 3,000 meetings in our meeting list, and they're all over everywhere. Something well over 90% of alcoholics of our type die drunk as a direct result of something. And it doesn't seem possible. I'm in a job today where I see alcoholics die from drinking. And there's a way out. I want to just, come on! But then I have to remember, if being sober was just a matter of good people telling you about it, why did I slip year after 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 year? I came to AA as kind of a high-bottom drunk. And I went to AA off and on when the heat was on for the next few years. I had a fairly successful career for a while, but it gradually went down. The last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a skid row mission and said, stay out of here, you bum. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and the New Yorker, Serving Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I've often thought, what was it? Why did I have such a difficult time with Alcoholics Anonymous? And it almost, I think it's a reason that a lot of people have, although I don't recognize. I didn't recognize for a long time. The first three steps of AA kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years. Not because they were bad, but because I did not interpret them correctly. Because even when you're new, you know, you come here and you find out, as I did in my first few meetings, what's an alcoholic? Person whose problem is alcohol. What do? They go to AA, admit their problem is alcohol, return to God, help others to feel good. None of that stuff applies to me. My problem is not really alcohol. It is when I'm drunk. No question about that. But that's not my problem. I don't know how to explain to people. I give myself the alcoholic test. Real alcoholics can't stop. I can stop, and I've stopped many times. My problem is not that I can't stop drinking. My problem is much more esoteric than that. I stop drinking, but in the 2 or 3 or 4 days, somebody sneaks into my bedroom and puts an invisible spring in my gut, and they tighten it the next morning. And it doesn't come out as I need alcohol. Come out just a little growing restlessness, just a little irritability, just a little tired of the sermons I'm getting, what I did, and on and on. And just there's not much relief in sight. And when I was successful, I spent a lot of money. I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to see what was causing that. And I read books, and I joined little cults and things. But I'll tell you what breaks that feeling. 2 or 3 drinks. That's all. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And then sometimes I drink too much again, and I say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? Yeah, I say, yeah, I guess it was. But inside, I just want to scream, no, it wasn't! You don't understand. There's an interesting concept there. There's something about me that's, when I'm sober, it's kind of out of balance. And alcohol does for me, it gets rid of that scale. And I didn't know it. I wouldn't know it to understand it. But from the first drink I took in the Pacific Ocean on a ship in the middle of World War II, some old guys got me to drink. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic, but I discovered one thing. A few drinks makes you feel better than almost anything I know of. And I went along. Later on, I took some tests in the Navy so I didn't have to come back to high school. I went to the University of Wisconsin, graduated out of there, went out and became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. And all these years I drank. Because drinking is possible for me in the world and function and do well. If you're kind of new, I'm going to tell you something shocking. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. States come and go. But when a few drinks is just filling that last void and you feel at last again, feel the way men look. God, that's a great feeling. You can always spot, how often thought, you know, there should be a test for alcoholics. Give them a drink. Then hear if they go, oh. What a great feeling. And I had no idea that I was getting an unnatural reaction. It's an interesting thing. In the book, there's a little section. I read that book when I first came to AA. My sponsor had me read that book. And I thought to myself, they say this is a badly written book. It is not a badly written book. Its defect is that it is the dullest book ever written. And so I just ignored it. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, my new sponsor said, read the book. I said, I read your book. So we'll read it again. And the only thing I noticed different was that it had become duller. You know, I write things like, I write big ads and commercials. Take this action. Buy this product. Do this thing. And you're looking here for a little excitement. And if you are thorough at this stage of your development, and the chapters are all different chapters, working with otherhood. More about alcoholism. Much to my surprise, when I was sober a while this time, I was reading it at a book study, where I was reading it, and I found myself reading this page, and I thought, my God, that's my story. If I'd have read that the first time I came today, I would still be here. And you may look around and think, what have you got in common with these people? All kinds of shapes and colors and sizes and all got different backgrounds and different drinking histories. What do you got in common? On one page in here, this guy has described, as far as I can see, much of what we have in common. It's in chapter 3, the first page. And he talks, one of the things people like us have in common because of the nature of what alcohol does for us. We have somewhere along the line had to voluntarily or involuntarily accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And it goes on to say people like us, I'm sure it's happened to all of us, occasional brief recoveries. Ha, I got it together now. I'll eat, then won't go out so late, don't you? Followed always by still worse relapse. A little bit worse, a little bit worse. And you finally get to a point that's such a tasty little phrase in there. Reach a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Remember reading that thinking, boy, they really are drunk to get to that point. But that isn't what that means at all. That's how you feel after you sober up. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And they want some kind of answers, and I am not prepared to give them. And so I'm very... I couldn't understand my pattern in life. I could not return to God. I envy people who believe in God. I mean, who don't believe in God. I used to come to A&D, like the atheists, because at least they had something to work with. I was raised in a very, very strict church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church in the middle of the country. And I've known where God was since I was 1 year old. He solely circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And ordinarily it wouldn't bother me, but I became one and married the other. If God exists, I am screwed. I know that. By the time I got to A this last time, I'd broken all Ten Commandments. And there's nobody's church where you get by with that. And much to my surprise, I fell into the hands of some people. I listened to him because he was a movie actor. What a terrible reason. And I didn't even listen to him for that reason. I listened to him because he was a movie actor. I thought he had some money and I'd maybe get something. He'd like to help a newcomer out. But he was a tough old guy. And, for example, I'm not an alcoholic because my problem is not really alcohol. Wish it were. The one time I ever stayed sober, gave it all I had, was in Texas. I stayed sober because I was in jail one night when my son died. And I felt so bad about that that I went on the wagon. And it got so bad, I did everything I knew what to do. And I couldn't get... One day I just put my car in the garage and committed suicide. And they pulled me out of there and put me in the state insane asylum. That's how I get with long-term sobriety. That's not... You think that's funny? Wait till I get to the part where I get to get leukemia and die. You'll like that. Jesus Christ. This is a tough crowd, I'll tell you. Marlene, call a cab. I'll be right out. But my problem, and he pointed out to me, I remember graphically he said, kid, if your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. What are you talking about, Bob? He said, you shouldn't be in AA if your problem is alcohol. Why do you say that, Bob? You embarrass me in front of the other people. I know better than that. I'm not an alcoholic, but even I know that. He said, the problem with is this. If your problem is alcohol, here's what you do, kid. You quit drinking and clean up your act, and you'll be okay. I said, that won't work, Bob. I've tried that 1,000 times. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol. Your problem is something that sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people get confused, but it's not alcohol. I said, what could it be, Bob? So something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. But he gave me a long harangue. And of what I don't remember much of, but I remember this, and it's something that planted inside of me, began to change my life, although I didn't know it. He said, kid, it boils down to this. An alcohol problem, you stop drinking, you clean up your act. In this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, my God, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They all say, stop drinking, it makes you feel better. I said, no, stop drinking for people like us makes you feel worse. I said, then why do these people drink, these alcoholics, why do they drink if they know it's going to eat them up? He said, they're not drinking it because they're going to eat them up. He said, you say you've been around A? All this time, don't you know this? An alcoholic is a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. You know that? Yes, I know that. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. And then you chant. Christ is enough to gag a maggot. He said, no, that's not it at all, kid. That's podium talk. What makes an alcoholic is he had a Coke in his hand. He used that as a demonstration. He said, the unnatural result is what alcohol does for us. He said, when I have a few drinks, it almost instantly changes the way things look. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it isn't really happening, you moron. It's in your head. And you'll drink until you get sober. And then you'll stay sober till you have to drink. I said, then why do you have to drink then? Why do you have to drink? A while back, somebody gave me a tape. They tested their tape machine when I was 3 years sober, just to tape my talk. Not been like that, they threw my tape away. But somebody found it and gave it to me. And I found myself quoting something Bob had told me that I hadn't talked in 30 years. But it's as true as ever. He said, kid, when people are born and you grow up, it's tough being a kid. There's a lot of things you got to learn. You got to learn how to deal with conflict, how to stay out of conflict, how to find a lot of problems. You got to find answers to the problems. You got to learn how to get along with people. You got to learn how to swallow your pride sometime. You have to learn a lot of things. He said, that's called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you'll lead a comfortable life. You can hold a job, get along with your kids, get along with the neighbors, go on square vacations and enjoy them, do things that are fun. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because we're a little more impatient. When we have a long-term problem, we can't find a quick solution to it, we have discovered we can drink it away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. All right, Mr. Collins, take your job and shove it up your nose, will you? And what you don't know is that you're building a closet full of unresolved emotional reactions. We call them alcoholic emotions. Perhaps the more correct term is childish emotions. I prefer alcoholic. What are alcoholic emotions? I love you. You hurt my feelings. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to run away. I can't stand it. Let's get married. Is there any word that's more terrible to an alcohol sponsor's ear than that terrible word? I want to tell you about my new relationship. I know I thought the last one, but when I saw this girl working out of dog coming out of detox today, I just And he pointed out to me, he says, people like us, every so often, sometimes along the way, want to quit and shape up. Going to quit and shape up. I've had enough crap now. I'm taking crap from people. I'm going to shape up. I'm going to go to work, come home at night, play with the kids, and not drink, go to the damn bars, and never once know that it is impossible for people like us to do that very long. Because sooner or later, someone will trigger one of those emotions. Someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will put me down. Someone will treat me with rancor, perhaps. And a job, and it starts again. And I just, when I was young, I used to pop people and quit. I realized I couldn't do that anymore. But I could, consumed with rage and resentment, and how to get even with that puke for doing that to me. And on and on, and bounce and mounts and mounts. And it gets so bad you can't even go to work. And there's only one way to ease it. Unless you have two or three drinks. And then it starts over again. And I say, why did you drink? I don't know. I was having a tough time at work. I don't know. Just dumb. He said, people like us, find the conflicts of reality unbearable. I said, Jesus, Bob, nobody ever told me that before. Why does it, if what you say is an alcoholic, that's what I am. Because most of my problems came sober, and I drank, and then, of course, drinking caused problems too. But my God, Bob, that's the story of my life. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, because he was profane. I thought, what could it be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I thought, my God, I'm an alcoholic. How could that be? After all these years, I could have known this 10 years, I would have been something. That was December of 1958, a long time ago. I've had a drink or a pill since. The best psychiatrist I ever went to told me I'd have to take some things for my depressions as long as I lived. But I couldn't afford them when I was first sober. Then I found out I was an alcoholic and didn't have to take them. But I've lived with some degree of comfort. I could not return to God. My sponsor said, it doesn't say a return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob? So it doesn't say that either. It says you come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in God? And I said, no, I can't. He said, can't you come to believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power, and I began to believe that he knew how I felt. I had never experienced that with another human being. You may not think that's very important, but I'll tell you, if you can find someone that you believe knows how you feel, I never, my dad didn't, my doctors didn't, my psychiatrist didn't, my employers didn't, they all said they did.
We know how you feel.
You no, you don't. But he knew how I felt. And so I did something with him I never could do with another human being. I told him about how secretly weak I am. Because I've always known that secretly down deep I'm a weakling. And I hate it. I hate it. That's why I hate weaklings, because they remind me of me. I'm a weakling. I never let a soul know it, and I was always brazen and tough and slick and hip and cool. I don't want you to know. I remember it got so bad in my early sobriety, I was living in an abandoned car and eating hand to mouth and getting crappy little jobs. And I said, Bob, I'm just a weakling. There's no hope for me. And there's nothing wrong, you know. Strong guys don't mind talking about their weaknesses. Yeah, part of my personality is being weak. But when you're a weakling, that's all you got. And you say, look at me, you can't possibly like me again. But he stuck with me. And he got me to take a little action that he gradually made me change. And he pointed out to me that the second step says, come to believe that a power greater than myself, whatever that might be, would restore me to sanity. And he had to point out to me that for people like me, alcohol induces temporary psychosis. Because psychosis changes your perception of reality. And I can do that. That's why alcoholics almost never become psychotic. They die from other form of insanity where your brain and liver dry up and you die with what's called the Korsakoff syndrome. But never become psychotic, really. I said, Jesus, Bob. Why doesn't AA explain it the way you do? Instead of all this baloney about allergy of the body to obsession of the mind and all that crap. He says, they do, kid. Look over there in the wall. One, all they ask you to do is admit you're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash. And they admit you to have a problem without alcohol. And he said something to me then that I would say to you if you're new. If that weren't true, you wouldn't be here. Because if you could drink, you'd be out drinking. If you can stay sober comfortably, you'd be out staying sober comfortably. When you can do neither, you're driven into places like this, and then watch your mind try to find any way to get out of here so you can have a drink. And it's funny, except that's what kills us. And little by little, he forced me to get those steps. That's the things I've done. And it turns out, oddly enough, in case you're new, wonder, what's the purpose of AA? Is it to get drier and drier and drier? Yeah. God, I've been sober 48 years. I'd burst into flame up here. Just you know. The purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality. To little by little change my relationship to the world around me. To give me some confidence and the ability to live in the world wherever I am. And nobody does it perfect. That's because we're humans. We're fallible. And we have ups and downs. But I think about that sometimes. I look back at that misbegotten, tragic, ugly, terrible, lost puke that was me on October 31st, 1958. And I wouldn't know how to help that person today if he came to me. Except maybe try to get him to listen about what AA is about. So that's why this meeting is kind of important, too. 13 years is a long time for any organization made up of fallible alcoholics of our type to survive. So something here is working. When I was in the, I want to close by saying, when I got out of the Texas Nut House, I wish I got out of there because I had stopped drinking for a while. Nothing in my commitment papers said alcohol, but they had the alcoholic warden in there. And I thought, if I can get transferred to that, I'll play those guys like a zither. So eventually I got moved into the alcoholic ward, and I didn't tell them I'd ever been an A before. I just thought I was a fast learner. And I did wonderfully. I got to be secretary of the group eventually. But, it was just wonderful. But what I hated about Texas, what they did there, I don't think you do much anymore, but the first meeting I went to, the counselor said, "My name is Les, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it's not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any narcotics since my sobriety date. And for this, I'm truly grateful." And I said, Les. And I thought, Jesus, if I ever get to be in a position of prominence, I wouldn't sing some dismal song like that. At least I'd tell the truth. So I've come here tonight at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience to tell you the truth. And the truth is this. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.